Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, we'd like to welcome everybody out to Prophecy Keepers Radio this evening. We're interviewing Will Hart, a man with a heart of gold and a will of steel. He's undergone a lot of travels and a lot of things to bring the message that he has for you tonight. He's been taught a lot of things by the elders, and he's also learned a lot of things through observation. And to me, I think he's kind of a shining example of what people should be after being in this country for 400 or 500 years. It's very clear from the Hopi prophecy that when European people came here, they were to learn from us, and we were to learn from them. And Will's done a great job in figuring a lot of things out. And without any further ado, I'd like to introduce not the star of stage and screen, but our television, but star of talk radio, Will Hart.
Well, thank you. That's kind of you. That introduction is quite flattering. I hope I can live up to that.
Oh, sure you can.
Okay, let's cover as much territory as we can here. To give you kind of an overview of the book and my work, what I'm trying to do with a couple of books in this Genesis Race series here, the first couple of books, is to introduce people to the theory that life on Earth was started by an extraterrestrial race that had already advanced on another planet. And a number of reasons for that we can get into later. But
or if it was once, it's a dead planet now.
Pardon?
Or if it was once, it's a dead planet now.
Yes. Well, our solar system is fairly young in the scheme of the cosmos, which is, you know, they're saying 15 million years. Could be older. I think it's much older, but let's say that this is the cycle that we're in now. We'll use 15 billion years, and the Earth is 4.5 billion. For another race to have evolved to the point where they would be far beyond us, they need much more time. Since it took us to get here on this planet about, you know, 4 billion years, we need another planet in another galaxy that originated much earlier than this one, that is much more ancient. To get here and plant the seeds of life here, as hopefully we will eventually do on other planets in our solar system and maybe beyond if we mature and get to that point. But anyway, that's the theory that I'm presenting, and with as much solid evidence as possible. Some of it's very solid, some of it's circumstantial, some of it is, you know, logic and inference. But in the first book, I started with a critique of Darwinism. There are a lot of holes, a lot of missing links in the theory of evolution as we know it. I'm not saying that I discount every single part of the theory. Some of it is well proven, like adaptation, response of organisms to natural pressures, to selection pressures, and so on. But on the whole, Darwinism does not explain, and I think most people are unhappy with any kind of cosmology that begins with accident, or that proceeds by accidents, by chance, mutations, which Darwinism does. Would you agree with that?
Well, I understand Darwin himself even was a little surprised at how far his theory went, and I have heard that, you know, by the time he passed away, he wasn't even a subscriber to his own theory.
Well, there are, you know, he, for instance, he characterized the problem of, you know, we know plants like ferns and very simple plants that don't produce with flowers, that don't produce sexually. And then we have plants which began, you know, producing flowers, and they have to go along with, co-evolve with bees, with pollinating insects. The problem is, how do you make the quantum leap from flies and simple non-flowering plants to flowering plants and bees, which are a lot more complicated than the more primitive varieties?
Mm-hmm.
What we need, what we would expect to find in the record is, and I'm talking about the fossil record, is some kind of progression of plants showing that these mutations occurred. In other words, if some plant like a fern started mutating and evolving towards flowers, where the heck are those plants that show the mutations? Well, they're not there.
Good question.
And so if we do the same thing with bees, since they have to exist together, because the bees have to pollinate flowers, how did this primitive fly evolve all of the complex features that bees have? Processing honey, pollen, you know, just making everything. They're very social insects that play a real pivotal role in the plant kingdom now, since flowers dominate. So in looking at these kinds of things, I spent 20 years with a botanist, and I've written probably about 250 natural history articles that have been published. And these were big questions for me that I couldn't answer and sort of brushed aside, but then I got very intent on, you know, I want answers to these things here. If they existed, they should be in the fossil record. I mean, some indication should be there that there was a progression, that there were intermediate forms that linked these ancient types of plants to the more modern plants. And then the next issue came to me was, and if those were improvements, as Darwinism would claim, that they were improvements each stage, the mutation do survive, and they're alongside the flowering plants. But none did. Where are they? There are no examples. So we have a lot of reasons to suspect that while parts of the theory seem correct, overall, it's not a good cosmology.
All right.
It's not a good explanation for the origin of life on Earth.
You've got so many different people, including a group of people that were fairly recently found in the rainforest in Brazil that I think it's the Uwa people. They said that that they migrated here, or two brothers that migrated here from you know, the Seven Sisters, what we call the Pleiades. There's several stories about that migration from the Pleiades, and which is kind of interesting because it's a nebula, it's a seven star system, and I wasn't raised as an Indian. I was taught later on, you know, about our cosmology, in particular Cherokee cosmology, and I just couldn't dismiss the verbal teachings of all these different cultures. How could they be so different from what's taught in schools? And I knew there had to be something there, so I've basically done the same kind of thing you have. Now, I understand that this was kind of a career. How long have you been looking into this? You used to be in the...
I would say late 60s is when I really first began seriously looking into UFOs, and then, you know, the first works of, like, Eric von Däniken and so on.
Right.
Then I took a trip down to Mexico and spent a year studying archaeology, anthropology, the archaeological sites down there, as well as the museums, and came back and just have continued studying since then.
But you were a writer previous to this on the Hollywood scene, right?
I've been a literary agent there. I've written scripts. I've produced, directed one film, produced three.
Gotcha.
And yes, I've been involved there too. And anyway, to try to keep the threads going here, in terms of, we've got the cultural Michelin links, and I want to follow up on the point you just made, that it's one of the key things, and I do have it in the book The Genesis Race, that we've got to get ourselves straight with this. Were our ancestors basically imaginative children, which is what modern scholars paternalistically call them on the one hand, or were they the geniuses that built the Great Pyramid and pyramid civilizations and learned how to create civilizations, tools, and display a lot of intelligence on the other hand? And what I'm saying is, we're presented with a very contradictory view of our ancestors. And I'm talking now universally of the human family, because they pretty much say the same thing of all groups, that while the Egyptians are supposed to have built the Great Pyramid, and we're supposed to look and revere them as, you know, wonderful engineers and architects and so on, in the next breath our scholars tell us that their own histories are not to be believed. And their own histories refer back to a time called the Zeptepi, the first time in which they were ruled over by gods, by an advanced race of beings who taught them everything. That history is entirely discounted as some fictionalized, nothing but mythology, make-believe. So which way is it?
Mm-hmm.
Are we to believe that these people who could build the Great Pyramid, if in fact they did, couldn't tell their own history accurately, that it was all make-believe nonsense?
Up until 500 years ago, or even 1,500 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot that was known in Western knowledge, you know, concerning the galaxy, much less the galaxy, our solar system itself. But it's very clear from going back into the record now that a lot of what we know about astronomy had to have been seeded here. It came in one lump, boom. It was gifted to us. And it was gifted to us in that, that time previous to, well, I guess it would be going back to what is now Iraq and into Samaria. It's very clear that, you know, before Samaria, not a whole lot was known, and then all of a sudden, boom, all kinds of information was just handed to us.
Right. And the Sumerians agree with the Egyptians that there was a long prehistory that humans were ruled over by the Anunnaki, the gods that came to this planet. So we have a consistency of ancient themes that talk about an advanced race coming to Earth and teaching people the arts and sciences of civilization. And unfortunately, our scholars have basically savaged those traditions, you know, relegated them to the circular file.
Oh, well, you know, more was known 5,000 years ago than was taught 2,000 years ago than was taught 500 years ago. Now we're finally starting to, you know, we're thousands of years down the road, and now our scientists are discovering, you know, the nature of the universe, the nature of matter and dark matter, and you know, whole new discoveries earlier this year on the meaning of cosmology, and all of a sudden we're catching up with the ancients and figuring out, hey, those people weren't so stupid.
Right. They weren't stupid at all, and they were telling us. Now, what I want to get to is that I came to a certain point in my own development and my research where I realized that this is a deep down issue here, that of trusting our ancestors, trusting the accounts that they tried to pass down to us. It's important. It will change you if you're able to do that. It will open up your mind and your vision and your ability to penetrate through these things and understand what they were really trying to tell us. That the universe is cyclical, that time, that human civilization, cultures go through cycles. And you can discern these cycles. And they tried to pass all of this information down, that they understood the cosmos better than we do. The solar religions, those priests, the pyramids, they were all used in ceremonies and rituals that at this point would be difficult for us to even understand, to conceive of them. So people have looked on the pyramid civilizations and just kind of wondered, well, why did they build those things? You know, what were they doing? Well, it's such a different, they had such a different way of being and a way of living and relating to the planet and other planets with the sun in the center of things that we've lost it, and it intrigues us, but we don't understand it.
Exactly.
And so my, you know, my quest has been to understand it to the depth that I could, and then to try to communicate that to other people. And I think I've come to the key was that we've completely lost in our, you know, machine-oriented technology, is that human beings were the center of their technology.
Mm-hmm.
The human being, the human spirit, the human psyche, the abilities to transcend space and time, to take in the energies of the cosmos, the other planets, and to use those. But where we are now is a completely opposite. The machines are important, and
mm-hmm.
we're just human beings.
Yeah,
this vast machine we call civilization now that's taken over the planet.
That's right. If people only knew how much better a technology it was to rely on your senses and also the information that you can get from spirit, they throw away machines in a heartbeat. But they just don't get it.
No, because the conditioning now is too strong. We've been broken down to where, and reduced to, to these material creatures that don't have much relationship to the natural world. We're mostly relating to machines, and the machines are very important. And we've lost the sense that we're the center of this whole thing. We're the key. We're supposed to be served by all of this, not to be the servants of it.
Odyssey. beautiful.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
And anyway, that was just very liberating for me to realize that. And I want to get it across to other people, you know, that we can, because where we are right now to me is disturbing. Because what we're saying and have been telling ourselves and told for generation after generation is all of these things are impenetrable mysteries. They're mysteries. We don't understand. And after a while, you take that for granted. You assume that's true, that, oh, I guess we can't understand it. No, this is our history. We better understand it. You know, if I told you, put yourself in the position tomorrow morning, you woke up and you forgot everything. You just don't remember a thing, complete amnesia.
Mm.
It wouldn't be acceptable, right?
Mm-mm.
But as a collective, we accept it. We're staggering around, we're wandering around, we're trying to figure things out, but we only get so far, and then we go, well, I guess I can't, I guess it's just a mystery. Yeah, but it means you lost a big part of yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you feel it, but you can't make the connection to it. And so I think where I am at now is that so many different people, and I mean individuals, I mean cultures, have pieces of this to bring to the table so that we can reconnect and make sense of our total history. And, you know, in the end, that's the drive. I mean, that's the drive that impels me, you know, to keep on questioning, to keep on penetrating through the, you know, the lies that we're told.
Well, you put that attitude together with a future guest I'm going to have on, Thomas O. Mills. He grew up in Holbrook, Arizona. I was telling you about him before the interview. His mother ran a restaurant, and you know, the Hopi would come down off their mesas, and when they came into town, you know, they'd eat at her place because people didn't run them off. So when it came time for them to build a cultural center, they asked his mom to run it, and he grew up on the Hopi lands at night, going up on the roof and being taught by the elders. And what they taught him, shockingly, was that the purpose of the pyramids at Giza and pyramids everywhere is that there are 8 pyramids at Giza. The message is we're going to be given 8 opportunities to literally balance. You know, Native people talk a lot about balance, but, you know, he was taught that it was literally that the pyramids were just like tire weights on a truck tire to literally balance the earth to keep it from wobbling so that it wouldn't flip over every few thousand years. You know, we've been through, three worlds now. We're going into the fourth. Or is it fourth world going into the fifth? I'm getting a little bit.
There are actually several different versions of the cycles.
And the
Maya have us, you know, going into the fifth world.
So the message was that, we have to all of a sudden, you know, it's like you said, as a collective, we've forgotten. Well, you know, the whole job was build pyramids along certain latitudes and certain places to offset perturbances in the planet's rotation to keep it on track. He shows that the unlike a lot of other places in Egypt where there's all kinds of writing and animals pictured all over the place, on the Giza Plateau, the only animals featured on the pyramids are those that are important to the Hopi religion. And he'll be an interesting guest. So you put your question that you just posed earlier, you know, have we forgotten what we're really supposed to be doing? And is it already too late for us to, you know, to start doing something about the planet's rotation before we flip over again?
Well, we have a lot more to deal with, you know.
And are we totally missing the point, you know, with all our technology? And instead of going to the moon, you know, maybe we should be looking at the ancient things and figuring out, what should we really be doing and where should we be doing it? And what should our priorities be as a planet? It's a tough thing, you know.
I think the priorities are, to preserve life on the planet, that life goes on and that we don't become, you know, near the last of the generations of human beings because we commit some terrible errors and unleash atomic bombs or do other things that just unravel the ecology of the planet,
right?
Which we're doing. And how do we now? We've got this steamroller going. Does it have a brake? You know, I mean, we've been looking for the brake for a while and can't seem to find it.
Yeah,
the steamroller just keeps going. So this quest has so many dimensions to it, and I know. Folks listening, I know you're in your own individual way on your own particular path with it as I am. But there are things I'm sure that the ancients passed along to us that the universe is all connected. We're involved in a unity. I think mostly the perturbances come from the human mind, from negative emotions in the human mind, and
which can. You know, they've proven scientifically now that positive intercessory prayer can help test groups of heart patients. And,
absolutely.
As a people, Gordon Michael Scallion years ago, when he came up with his predictions, a lot of people faltered and said, oh, well, it didn't come true. Well, there always was that caveat. He said, well, it all depends on the condition of the people that are on the planet and, how they're thinking, how they're acting. And, that kind of attitude can agree with just about every religious position that anybody's ever taken on the planet. You know, if you're good, good things are going to happen. And if you're doing bad stuff's going to happen to you. It's real simple.
And as a race, that's where we are now because the planet is so interconnected. The technological systems, the communications have linked us together so closely that, something happens, in Iraq and we know about it right away.
Now, it's a very tenuous, very, the power grid goes down, it's all gone.
Yes, and maybe that's, the 2012, the research I've done there, because I spent time in Mexico, time with different Mayan tribes, and I've been working on that for a long time. And the last piece to me was the Venus transit, and it ties in with what you just said, because our civilization is electromagnetic. found out that we get enough solar flares, enough solar activity, that system goes down.
Yeah, we lost a couple satellites on that last one.
Yeah, and radios go down, and we could have the power grid go down if it gets really extreme enough. But in the work I've done on that, I went back through history, and we talked about this briefly before the show, that the era, the 1518 through 1526 era, there was two transits of Venus, and it happens in a pairing 8 years apart, about one every 120 years. So nobody alive today has experienced the Venus transit. But that was the period of time in which Quetzalcoatl was predicted to return to Mexico. They were concerned, and of course Cortez showed up in 1519. But they had also been preceded by some very strange things that the people reported to Bernard de Sahagún, and he was a Spanish chronicler, that there were there was a pillar of fire that was on the horizon for about a year prior to that, and there were shields flying in the sky, giving dire warnings to the people. So I think when we're looking at that, we're looking at the transit period there that, you know, was the end of the Aztec civilization, the end of the last pyramid civilization, and we're tying that together with this 2012 prophecy. We have a Venus transit on in June of this year, and then the second transit on December 21st, 2012.
So Venus transits mean trouble, right?
Venus transit, right, has been tied together, you know, has been tied to, just like I said, that cataclysmic event in Central America, you know, the conquest. That's when it happened, 500 years ago. And what it is, you know, it's just the Venus passing between the sun and the earth. Now, the next passage that happened was in 1631, 1639, and then in 1640, for the next 70 years, there were no sunspots. So the earth cooled down. The earth went through a mini ice age for about 80 years. And then since then, you know, we've been in the 300-year increased sunspots, increased warming. And really, when you look at it, you look at the 20th century, and it's just the most violent time in human history that we know of. Massive wars, terrible weaponry, people, you know, nation against nation.
Entire worlds in commotion.
Yeah, just terrible chaos and kind of a sense of, you know, what has happened to civilization? What happened? You know, why did it become so barbaric and savage? So here we are, you know, here we are now facing, still at war, still, you know, not living the commandments we were given. As we were saying, you know, there are, you know, this negative energy keeps on winding on us, and can we counterbalance it?
Well, you know, you're talking about sunspots, and that brought to mind, I was out in New Mexico, it was last year sometime, and it was a clear day. Now I'm almost 50 years old, and I've been an amateur astronomer avidly, you know, from the time I was about 12 until I was in my 20s, and I still read. I don't, you know, take pictures through telescope like I used to, but I still keep my eyes on the sky, and I know what's out there, I was driving out one evening, and just as the sun was going down, and I saw this huge sunspot. I mean, it was this huge black thing on the sun. As it was going down, and I looked at it and I went, "Wow, that is huge!" And you know, and I looked at it. I watched it for several minutes, and it couldn't have been anything between me and the sun. It could only have been a sunspot. And it was absolutely huge. So I was thinking, wow, you know, how come we're not hearing about those kind of things in the media?
Well, there's so many, you know, I think scientists are aware that we're in a different cycle, in a different era, and they communicated in what they do, but they don't, you know, put out the information. And what I mean is, for instance, when the comet Shoemaker-Levy hit Jupiter, that came as a total surprise. This wasn't something predicted years in advance. It's not something anybody expected. It was shocking. It was terrifying because it would have destroyed the Earth had it hit it. And then all of a sudden, in the last 15 years or so, we've been hearing of more and more asteroid flybys, which I don't remember when I was a kid of hearing of any.
Mm-hmm. Well, they may not have had the means to track them either.
Well, I think, you know, they could have seen an asteroid flying close by.
Oh, yeah.
I guess what I've been saying is that they keep being surprised by these things.
Uh-huh.
When we're given the impression that, hey, everything's pretty stable and predictable, and we know where all these cosmic objects are, and don't worry, and these things come flying by, and then 1 week you don't hear about it, and the next week you do.
And, so, and always after the fact.
Yeah, and this, and exactly right. In fact, we had one recently here. And
that one recently, it was between us and the moon. It was within a 250,000 miles, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's close.
That's close.
You know, astronomically, we're talking about a bullet going right by you, grazing your skin, you know. That's very close. And the point is that in prophecy, in ancient science, that's predicted. I mean, the Maya basically predicted two things. Earthquakes, that this is called the sun of motion in the Maya scheme, and it will end in a cosmic object impact and earthquakes.
Well, that's what the children and the other people at Fatima saw, and the children were told the world would have 8 days' notice. Well, maybe that's an incoming something, you know. If you go back and study the Fatima prophecy, it was fairly clearly something coming in from outer space.
And so that's pretty clear. Now, have we had an increase in earthquake? Well, there's debate, but according to the data that I gathered, there's a steep increase in major. Now, what scientists do, and you know the old thing about massaging statistics to, you know, to support any kind of idea you have. But what I did was I was only interested in the major earthquakes. Was there a rise in a major earthquakes that could have, you know, a devastating impact? And there's no overall rise in the total number of earthquakes, and there are just, you know.
So you're talking about like over 7 point?
Yeah, I'm looking at like 6 point and above.
Right.
And what I found was since 1960, there was a dramatic rise in the major earthquakes on us. I mean, a dramatic rise, and especially in the 1990s.
Huh.
It becomes quite real obvious. And maybe I'll send you just that data and you can post it so people can go and look at it.
Oh, speaking of posting, we got folks out there, I'm sure. Most people are going to be listening on the internet, and in the future, this may get picked up by broadcast. So, you know, let's take a second and talk about your website and your books and move on. You know, if you'd like to, whatever you'd like to do.
Oh, my website is just www.genesisrace.com, and you know, people are welcome to go there, and then they can email me right from that site, and I respond to all the emails.
Excellent. And I'll have a link to you from my site. It'll be there forever.
Okay, we'll do that. And like I said, I'll send you that data so that people can just go and look at the earthquake data, because it's important to people, because this is not me and my prediction. This is what I've gathered from, and it's a body of knowledge that I consider to be ancient science. And really the purpose of this ancient science was to guide people in the future, was to indicate, look, we understood these things a long time ago. Here is what you need to know now to survive.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated and freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now.
Put it
Osmond.
Under your bed. Put it in your closet. Give it for Christmas to people and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
Well, if you're a Bible believer, you know, especially you believe, you know, Matthew 24, where Jesus himself was saying, hey, you know, when the fig tree leaves, you know, the summer's not. In other words, he's trying to tell us when you see these things coming to pass, you'll know that we're getting close. And one of the things that was prophesied was earthquakes in diverse places and in increasing frequencies.
Yes, so, what he said. That was exactly one of the key signs that we were at least approaching the end times.
And then there's the other thing about a generation is usually, 40 years in the Bible? Well, you mentioned, you know, a generation ago in 1960 is basically when all these things started up. So, you know, those are a couple of red flags people should be thinking about.
Absolutely. And so if we know that we're there, the signs, and we start to know what to look for and how to prepare ourselves, you know, spiritually, socially, things that we should start doing, and to get some sense of, you know, what the urgency level is. I don't think we're towards the end of the end times or even in the middle. I think we're closer to the beginning. But things can accelerate, and so we just need to be aware. It's sort of like wake up, you know, and pay attention. That's part of my message, and it's something I tell myself all the time, you know. And I notice the world is getting more confusing every day. You look out there and you get all this news and you see the things going on and it doesn't make a lot of sense. Our leaders, our so-called leaders, aren't making a lot of sense. People don't know why we're at war. They don't know why we go to this war. And oil prices go up instead of going down. And it's sort of like an upside-down world we're getting. And it's part of it. I mean, just understand that it's part of this process.
Yeah, and oil, you know, it's, you know, in the Book of Revelation, it says, you know, be sure, you know, not to harm the oil. You know, so it's, so, you know, oil's definitely, you know, part of the picture.
The chaos in Iraq you brought up earlier, that is ancient Samaria, the Tigris-Euphrates mentioned in the Bible. We know that Samaria was the first civilization, at least in this cycle of civilizations, which has been about 5,000 years. The Hopi prophecy I read was that, you know, the people that first got the wisdom would be attacked, would be plunged into a war. Well, there we are. And then leaders of nations would hunt other leaders like animals. Pretty astounding.
Yeah,
and there we are again, is more confirmation. Now, that's what I'm looking for, is confirmation from different cultures, from different peoples, that to be able to read these signs and to really understand, and then to move on to communicate to, you know, what we really need to do, how much time we have, what we need to do. And, you know, like I said, like you just mentioned earlier, you know, the scientists, they're concerned about earthquakes. They're concerned about volcanoes. They know they've been increasing. That's why would they all of a sudden form all of these specialized sciences just to predict volcanic eruptions? Because we've had a lot of them in the last 40 years, an increasing amount of them. So they've been trying to more and more hone this down to be able to predict when the next ones are going to occur. And I have several chapters in the book about end times and presenting people with information and letting them interpret. Now, I'm not here as some kind of final authority, just as a messenger to put this out and to let people decide.
Well, I know they seem to be getting their earthquake science right here lately also.
Yeah, they're getting much better. I agree. They're getting much better at that. And so we may within the next few years have a pretty good grasp of what we're facing. And I know there's a lot of concern has been, you know, about Yellowstone. The pressures at Yellowstone, indications seem to be building that something is going on there. They were pretty good with Pinatubo back there 10, 12 years ago. They were able to predict that. It was a massive eruption.
There's a little known prophecy of the Chickaraugan Indians of Michoacan. In 1939, well, in the 30s, there was a Navajo two brothers, Paul and Natoni Nezba, that were students of Haskell. And they were down in Mexico. They went through a lot of the ruins, you know, before they were closed up or flooded out, and they went through a lot through South and Central America, and they found out about a group of Indians in the King Mountains east of the capital of Michoacan, and I think we're only talking about 100 miles, but it took them a long time to get in there, but they ended up going in and the meeting with a group of people who had a lot of records, and I guess at one point they were taken into the jungle blindfolded for 2 weeks, and they were allowed to view records that had been around since the time of Cortez's incursion. But their spiritual leader down there, Jose, taught them a lot of interesting things, and one of them was that someday there'll be a tremendous fire and explosion and up here in the States that the people down there will be able to see. Now that's big. That's a big.
Yes, massive and unimaginably destructive.
And they were told that they were to wait a year for the air to clear and then start moving up. And they have been making preparations since the late 30s. Matter of fact, in 1939 and 40, there were two meetings at Lake Pátzcuaro that were covered by Life magazine. And I had a copy of the article. It was called Calling All Chiefs. And there was, I think, 250,000 Indians at the first one and maybe 400,000 at the second. And it was a literal prophecy conference. And Jose taught them about this prophecy, about the migration that was going to be happening, and told the people what to do to get ready for it. That one group that both groups would basically follow the Gulf of Mexico until they got up to about what is today modern day Laredo, and then they would split. One would go continue along the coast to what is now the west side of the Mississippi and follow it. Which would keep them on course. If they stayed on the west side of the Mississippi, would put them on the south side of Missouri, and until they got to White Cliffs, and that's the only place in the Missouri where you've got that, so near the Kansas City area, and they were to build there, and the other group was to continue up along the Rocky Mountain chain, and they were instructed that if they found any survivors, they were to bring them in and treat them well, unless they were attacked. And if they were attacked, they were instructed to conquer. But they've been told that they're going to be coming up here, and they're going to be inheriting, re-inheriting this area, and they've been making their preparations.
Well, that particular prophecy, I hadn't heard, but I'll accept it as...
Yeah, not many have.
No, and maybe it might be productive to talk a little bit about the number 13 and how that factors in. Plays a very strong role in the whole of Mesoamerica.
And the United States also. It's all through, you know, it's 13's everywhere. You know, 13 colonies, 13 stars in the constellation,
right.
And oh yeah, absolutely.
That's true too. And yet 13 is also considered superstitiously as a negative number.
Right.
But it really, 13 is important, real important in the ancient science. I think it was the basis of the ancient science. By all the indications we get. And so I've been trying to establish, well, what was the reason for that? And it's real simple. I mean, 13 is it's a prime number, for one thing. It's also one of the Fibonacci series numbers. And are you familiar with
mm-hmm.
that? Yeah. So we're talking about a number with a lot of power that... And the Fibonacci series is important because it yields the golden mean, the 1.618, which is, kind of boils down to 1.6, which describes the spiral.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how a spiral, but also how many things grow in nature. So it would make sense that the ancients, observing nature, observing the motions of planets, and it's interesting because Venus moves around the Earth 1.6 times, and then they blink back up again.
Yeah, the Fibonacci, even down to what we consider to be beautiful in a woman's face.
Yes. It has those proportions.
Exactly. And our fingers and our digits, and it's all through nature. It's amazing.
It's all throughout nature and all throughout ancient architecture. So when I realized that, I went, well, what happens if I did a base 13 series. In other words, 13 plus 13, 26, plus 13, 39, plus 13, 52, plus 13, 65, and then 78, 91, 104. And I was amazed when I stood back and realized that describes the Maya, the Mesoamerican calendar, and calendars in general. I mean, it's just using 13 as a base 13 system, you generate the basic numbers in the solar system that describe the motion of planets. Does that make sense?
It does.
You know, so you see this real simple system there, but tremendously powerful, and they incorporated that into the pyramids. For example, at Chichen Itza, then you look at it and you go, pyramid has four sides, the four seasons. Each season, right, is 13 weeks long. Each one of those sides of that pyramid down there has 91 steps. Well, that's part of that 13 series, too. You know, 91. So you start to see, wow, there's tremendous power in this. 52 weeks in a year. So even if we don't, even if Western civilization doesn't like to acknowledge 13, it's the center of the system. So, you know, I see it incorporated in all the pyramids, in all four-sided pyramids. They were, of course, they're going to be built to reflect the Earth, to reflect the Earth's position in the solar system, and you couldn't pick a better number than that to represent, you know, the whole thing, and yet we've basically tossed it out here, although native cultures have maintained it. Certainly in Mexico they maintained it. It's also in the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid has a descending passageway and an ascending passageway. They were also set at 26 degrees, both of them. It comes out to 52 degrees. And maintained at very precise angles, down below the pyramid, it goes 150 feet at a 26-degree angle, and up into the chambers above the ground, it's maintained at 26 degrees. And then the outer, you know, the outer edges of the pyramid are not quite 52, but they're 51 degrees, 51 minutes.
Hmm.
Pretty close.
Oh, yeah, within 9 minutes.
So, you know, we're looking at an ancient science, like you were saying earlier, that comes from a very high degree of intelligence. I mean, it has such understanding to it that was given to us. And another thing about the Great Pyramid and the Pyramid of the Sun down at Teotihuacan and Cahokia, close to where you are, that mound there, the bases of those pyramids are almost all the same, within a few percentage, you know, a few degrees. They're almost all 13 acres, as if they were built, as if they were made that size based on a template, and based on a need to be that size. So, we find around the planet, you know, these relationships, these artifacts, this system that reflects, you know, the cosmos, our place in it if we understood it. And we don't need a super complicated physics and all these things, you know, all these specialized systems that are fragmenting us and confusing us, really. It's like you were saying, there's a natural harmony in that Fibonacci series. If you understand that and then build your structures according to that, it's harmonious, it's pleasing, you feel good, you know? And it's very hard to go around. I guess the thing that I'm offended by when I travel around our country here is that so many of the cities are just ugly. So much of what you see just strikes you as ugly. You don't even want to look at it.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
It's just, and then we kind of take it for granted, but it's depressing to the human spirit. You know, and no wonder. I mean, so many people are depressed, and they're into drugs and alcohol, and they don't see any point to life, no sense of meaning. And, you know, those things just drive you down. I mean, if you go from war and bad news and rip-offs and betrayals and you don't know who to trust, you know, you start to see this system just kind of spiraling down.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It's the little yellow pill that scientists say could eliminate chronic diseases and help you live well into your hundreds.
You might be able to increase the lifespan of a mammal by 50%. And, of course, if that was a human being, then that might be in the order of 130 to 150 years.
That claim might be hard to swallow. But tonight on ABC's Primetime Live, co-anchor John Quinones takes the promising antioxidant therapy called Protandim.
I have become a guinea pig for ABC News and Primetime. It's not a drug. It's a supplement. It's called Protandim, and it's a combination of five exotic plants that have been around for centuries.
Have you discovered the fountain of youth?
I wouldn't put it that way, but we may have discovered something that will tell us a lot more about how we age, what happens biochemically, and maybe how we can slow it down.
Quinones has been taking Protandim for 2 weeks now and tells Extra,
I am sleeping better. I feel a lot better and also energized when I do wake up.
Primetime puts Protandim to the test tonight.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
And I think if my remedy to that is just to go out in nature somewhere. I don't know what you do, but I just...
Well, that's why I move where I am. I'm in the Ozarks in southern Missouri.
Yeah, and you go take a walk, you know, through the woods, you sit by a river, you go to a lake, you instantly feel better.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
It almost doesn't matter. So that... You know, that kind of does, that kind of puts us back in touch with the Creator, that, hey, you know, this world is really fine. I didn't create it for you to be miserable or confused and killing each other and fighting over everything. And see, when you experience this, or like you, I share the same fascination with astronomy. I go out and look at the stars at night. It's incredible. know, I look at the blue sky during the day, and I'm amazed that just the blue sky, a wide open blue sky, is beautiful. It's, you know, I feel good. So what's the problem? Well, we come back to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went from a system that was set up and it was harmonious and orderly to one that started degenerating and degrading, and so we're sort of at the end of that.
Well, I know, you know, one prophecy I read years ago that said that in the last few years, you know, you'd want to cancel your newspaper subscription, turn the TV off, and that because it would contribute too much to negative mental health.
And it does.
Just too much bad news.
That's right. And what point is it? You know, you realize that while you were taught that, you know, the mass media is a public service, it's a business. They're just there to make a profit.
Yeah.
They're not there to inform you. They could care less. They might do that incidentally, but you're not getting the total truth. And I think anybody that's, you know, awakened at all realizes that.
And then our government wonders why we don't trust them. You know, well, that's, you know, as far as Americans go, I mean, we were taught that way. And, you know, and then when we hear that, you know, our government looks askance at us if we don't trust them, then, well, it's kind of like, you know. But, no, I think we're getting to the point where, you know, there's just too much bad news.
There is. There's far too much, and you can't keep yourself exposed to it because it will affect you, and you will feel that spinning inside of yourself. Confusion, anger, depression, the whole thing.
Well, it's like you can't live with someone who's mentally ill without becoming mentally ill yourself.
Yeah, and if we're in a culture that's circulating this all the time,
that's,
how can you not become infected?
That's absolutely right. You know, we're
strong resistance.
Well, I was talking with my wife today about this. One prophecy is that the Bible predicts that during this period of time that men would lose their natural affection. And you can certainly see that with the advent of serial killers, which is something that's, you know, fairly new. Well, it may not be new, but there seems to be a lot more than there used to be. I know this one guy, two psychics pointed the police into his direction, and he actually passed the lie detector test. And, you know, if you're a sociopath and you don't have any feelings, you know, the lie detector, or at least the polygraph, set up that you'll have emotional responses if you do lie. Well, if you're sick in the head, you could pass, and there are other ways to pass. And, I've been taught a couple ways because I was taught some things.
Well, I think we have a lot of people like that now who are sociopaths. Real human feelings.
Exactly.
Who lack empathy with other people. They can't put themselves in other people's shoes. I mean, they literally can't do it.
Well, the polygraph examiner was just incredulous when he found out that later on this guy actually admitted to the crime. They said, hey, that was the first guy I knew of that was guilty and passed the test with flying color. So, you know, voice stress analysis, that's something it's kind of hard. You know, police, you know, all the tools they can get, and, you know, lie detector never was a tool for anything except weeding people out and threatening them into giving confessions. But, hey, you know, if you're using a lie detector nowadays to try to weed through suspects, you know, you could be missing some things. And because there are people that are sick enough that they won't have any galvanic skin response or...
Look at the truth. I can't even tell you the truth. I'm shocked by so much of what's been going on for the last couple of years that's headline news and yet treated sort of like ho-hum. I mean, people have become incredibly indifferent, and I'm talking about average people, not necessarily sociopaths, but just average people who you would think, you know, have a conscience and a sense of social responsibility, just going ho-hum, so priests raped boys.
Yeah.
Oh, well, next.
Oh, yeah, so
you go from one thing to another, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't, so CEOs ripped off elderly people of their life savings. Ho-hum, next door.
Yeah, it did happen to me, so why should I care? That's another thing about, you know, lacking natural affection, worrying about your fellow man. And I think that, you know, there's good and bad to everything. Several different nations' prophecies say that this would be a time of great communication, but whenever you have something that's really good, you can have it be really bad also. And, you know, violence on TV and then the breakdown of the family, you know, especially...
The trivialization of so much of our life.
Oh, yeah.
So much of what it is to be human just trivialized down into where people can't talk about the large questions. I mean, they just don't know how to do it. And yet, you know, we're reduced to all these non-stories and non-issues in our media, which tends to reinforce, you know, that, well, I guess these are things I ought to think about.
Yeah, reduced to sound bites, and all of man's problems have to be resolved in an hour or two, because that's how long TV shows.
And by an expert. So
yeah.
Not by ordinary people
uh-huh.
who have to use their own critical faculties, just by some expert who, you know, flops out his little version of reality for you, and you're supposed to just consume that and move on. You know, yes, we're in a system now that looks like total gridlock. I mean, it just is self reinforcing. You know,
and the kids nowadays, they laugh at the Leave It to Beaver. You know, there was a lot of wisdom that was passed along, a lot of common sense.
Yeah, it looks totally unreal to a kid now in this era. You know that things could be so innocent. It just looks like fake, you know?
Well, I grew up, I'll be 50 years old in December, and I grew up in the early 60s, most of the time in California, but, you know, summer vacations and other visits, you know, my mother's home was in Mississippi, and my grandparents were, middle class, and they lived near a large, very poor group of black people. And I had the privilege and honor of being taught by some of those black elders. You know, a lot of them were totally ignorant, couldn't read, but let me tell you something. They had, and they prized, common sense. And I can look back on it now, and I can say, man, those people understood the rhythms of life and how things work and how things grow and acceptance of things that they couldn't change. But if they knew, they thought there was something they could change, they knew how to go about doing it, you know, within reason, by using common sense. And I think a lot of us have totally lost that innate sense of what's right and what isn't. And using moderation in all things. Our society has just gotten into totally outrageous in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and you can tell by the words, by the concepts that just kind of go out of fashion, you know, they become antiquated, like thrift. I mean, you don't hear the word anymore.
Unless they're laughing at it.
It's just gone. I mean, that's, you know, that was alive a generation ago, but it's just not a quality anymore. It's not a characteristic that, you know, people are even thinking about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there are many. I mean, virtue, you very seldom hear that. I mean, it seems as much of a joke now as Leave It to Beaver. So the whole culture shifted into a much more cynical, you know, take for granted that everything's a con, that people don't really mean what they say, that there's insincerity everywhere, and we see it all the time. So that, too, is just the conditioning, you know, that... and so somebody, you know, somebody's got to break the cycle. I mean, you got to step out of that, right? And say, look, I'm dealing with this whole thing. You know,
well, it used to be, you know, it was 150 years ago, it was, you know, native people that were pointing at dominant societies and pointing out the same things that we're talking about society as a whole now. And, I know one native teacher, you know, pointed out to me. He said, "Well, you know, we're all black folks now. You know, we're all being, everybody's being oppressed now. It's not just Indians. It's not just blacks. It's everybody.
We're
oppressing each other and being oppressed."
That's exactly how it is. I mean, that's so. think the only remedy really is the truth. I mean, that's what I put as a value really unto itself. And of course, you know, anytime you bring that up, people are going to say, well, what do you mean? You know, whose truth, what truth? Is there any absolute truth? Is it all relative? Do you really just mean your opinion? No. It's got to be something more than just opinion and each individual point of view, because I don't see how we can have a society, really, or real just organization and trust and like you're saying, some kind of empathy, if it's all just, you know, each one of us in our own little world and universe.
Well, from all the aspects you look at it, all the prophecies basically say that we're going to be taken back to the dirt. And, you know, that's particularly the Chickamauga Cherokee prophecy, that we're going back to the dirt, the Creator's going to put us back there. You know, that's the best place He could put us in. Because it'll, you know, with the, I mean, a lot of people talk about how horrible the thinning of the population would be, and a lot of people think that it's something that's being planned by governments, but hey, you know, I'm sure the people in high places know about these kind of cycles, and I'm sure they've got plans for those of us, you know, after these things happen. And so, you know, it's kind of like that movie, The Postman. You know, you remember that movie with Kevin Costner movie? Yeah, that was, you know, the big thing about all the how horrible the U.S. government was, and the people in the country got together and they destroyed the government, and then they set up, guess what, regional feudal systems, and you know, and that's the worst kind of tyranny you can get, is to be, you know, ruled over by the local warlord, and so, you know. Exactly.
With a lot of futility. It's not going to happen. Iraq is not going to turn into a democracy. We're wasting lives. We're wasting a tremendous amount of money. And whoever said this was going to happen, just because a few people in Washington decided that, you know, the most ancient people on the planet, if they could just wave a wand over them and change them.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Who are we? Who are we? I mean, you know, this young country that, you know, just... The rest of the world now is starting to look at us, and you know, there's ancient parts of the world, you know, that sure, you know, you go ahead and you tell us what to do, and you know everything.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pomposity, a lot of arrogance. But there again, is it really us? I mean, I don't feel that the administration is acting out my will. I don't feel that our so-called representatives represent me. I think a lot of people feel that way, and they don't vote. They don't feel connected. They feel that they're just dragged along.
Well, this whole thing.
What race they are, you know?
Yeah, this whole thing in Iraq, it may be a big. We may be further along in the scheme than we really know. This whole thing may be a Hail Mary play of the highest order. You know, this. We could be in a lot of trouble, and the government knows it, and they're not saying. And you know, there's. It's like. Churchill said, you know, nothing happens in politics by accident. It's all planned.
Well, it brings up, you know, in relation to the work I'm doing and this book and the next one, because I'm not just looking at ancient civilizations and mysteries and so on. I'm looking at the modern-day UFO problem and really ascertaining, is this, does it have historical continuity? Are we talking about, you know, a race or races that have been involved with human beings since time immemorial, and we're involved in this drama now. You know, post-World War II, a whole new phase of it shifted into gear when we exploded nuclear bombs that seemed to be what really changed things.
Yeah.
What drew attention to New Mexico, where it happened, where the first early flaps in Roswell were. Did that put us in a new relation to the rest of the universe that has suddenly draw attention? Well, going back in time, you find that the earliest civilizations, you know, all said that they were, you know, that they were started by an advanced race that came and lived with them and taught them how to live and taught them laws and gave them tools, and then turned over the reins to human beings, to pharaohs, to kings. You know, we have that, the divine right of kings, and all the early theocratic civilizations. Did human beings really invent that? Well, none of them said they did. Our scholars say they did, but none of them said they did. And so this whole continuum, if we're involved with a race that is more advanced than we are, then a lot of this can be testing, right?
Right.
A lot of this can be testing, like, you know, how far have we developed?
Well, a lot of people don't realize that the same things are going on now that went on before the great deluge. And it was prophesied that it would be this way also. We talked about this before the show.
Exactly.
As it was in the days of Noah, so it shall be in the latter days. Well, this interbreeding deal that was going on with alien abductions and this kind of stuff was going on before the flood.
Yeah, and it was even going, the Nephilim interbreeding with human females. The Nephilim were another race, were a more advanced race, and produced the race of giants. And I think giants also meant physical stature, but also that they were superhuman. I mean, they were far beyond ordinary people, right?
Yeah, and who are the 9 to 12 foot giants that, you know, we are finding their bodies even to this day, you know, right, including the hair. And who are these people that Native people were so intent on destroying, and also that, and I'm talking about here in North America, but also the descendants of the Philistines that the Hebrews were so intent on destroying.
Yeah, that was the whole, the covenant with God in the Bible with Abraham to go to Canaan and take it over, to get rid of the descendants of the Nephilim, of the giants that had kind of clustered in that area. But apparently they were around the world. That was, the Israelite story was to get rid of them, but from what I've heard from you, this was also here in this country too.
It was. I kind of wonder, what do you know about the connection between these giants and the so-called mound builders?
Well, I've read about it. What I've read is that in the 19th century, when white settlers were in the area and probing those mounds, that they uncovered giants inside the mounds. And we kind of go back to this thing where specimens were sent to the Smithsonian and then they just disappeared.
Buried, yeah. Because I know my teacher, John Red Hat, taught me that after the Cherokees came up here the second time, from Mexico, that they settled in here in the Ozarks, and then we moved into the southeast and even as far as almost as Pennsylvania from there. But when we encountered the mound builders, we fought a war with them, resolved the war by intermarrying with them. And now our people have always insisted on our outlet to the sea, and our archaeologists, ethnologists have noted that we have the dolicephalic, long-headed type skulls that the Egyptian people and Phoenician people have. But one of the things that DeSoto commented in 1540 when he arrived here was that our men were a lot taller than the average Native American, but we didn't have the high cheekbones. Plus, there were red-headed children running around our streets, and also blonde-haired and blue-eyed children. We've apparently always been a mixed blood group of people. And,
well, the mtDNA seems to indicate that too, with the haplogroup X. But that's the only haplogroup that's shared all around the Atlantic.
Right.
That's in Europe, that's among Europeans, and that was in the mound builder. I mean, the mound builder, some ancient remains have that haplogroup.
And
it's in a very, very tiny percentage of the world's population.
Yeah. Well, our people were taught in 1750 that by out of Gokula that we came from over the Eastern Ocean. before we came here. And, you know, that will explain, you know, all the similarities between us. And a lot of people, you know, used to think that we were lost Israel. But no, no, it's that it, us and Israel and Hittites and Egyptians and everybody on the planet, you know, came out of Samaria and had those kind of cultural and even language and address burial customs. They have all those connections.
And it looks to me, I mean, logic would argue that people first came to South America and then came north, and some people came down from north, right?
We did, yeah.
Because it looks like what you're saying, you know, that you came from the Pacific, right?
Our origin story said that before we came to where we are now, we were on an island off the shore of South America.
That makes sense to me, because where do we find the, you know, the early civilizations down there? That it makes, those make no sense in terms of the Bering Strait theory.
Yeah.
Because it would have taken the longest time for people to filter down into Peru and Bolivia and all the way down there. And yet if people had started down there and trekked northward, right? And that's exactly what the MT, you know, the genetic studies have shown. There were at least three different migration areas.
Well, Peru seems to be the place. And the other thing is that corn, most of the corn in the world is 13 chromosome corn, except for the corn that grows in Peru and all throughout the Pacific, which is 9 chromosome corn. So, you know, that's the old original corn, and it either originated in Peru and moved out to the Pacific or vice versa. But there was, you know, the terminal point was in Peru. And those elders down there, when they were visiting a few years ago, said that, you know, when some Cherokees went down and talked with Don Enrique, they said, well, what's the connection between your people and ours? And I think he was a Quiche Mayan. And he said, we're the same people. He said he could even tell us where to go in Egypt to prove it to ourselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, that makes sense to me.
And Peru is also the ancient cultural connection between the sunken cities, you know, the sunken civilizations that are now referred to as Atlantis and Mu,
right.
Sargon and Sargon, you know, which were our last guest, our last guest and the two guests previous to him, they're both come from the spiritual tradition of the Asaga. And they pointed out that the Mayans were actually missionaries from what we call Lemuria and or Mu, and that they were sent there to continue the spiritual tradition. And that goes along with the Cherokee, the Keturah origin story, migration story, is that we came from an island off the coast of South America. Our elders were misusing something called white fire, and that we knew that our island was going to sink, and that or it was revealed to us metaphysically, and a lot of us just left. And that island's no longer there. It's either that or the island is now or it was destroyed, and it may be under the ice cap in Antarctic now. Very possible, because of Plato's description of the thumb of Atlantis, you know, makes Antarctic a pretty good candidate.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot more sense. You know, people need to understand now that, you know, the Bering Strait thing has largely been given up now, except as one migration route.
Well, sure, some of them came that way.
But the genetic studies, the mtDNA studies, which have just really come out in the last couple of years, have proven it. They know now that they can't trace all of the genetic, and mtDNA is the maternal.
Right.
Right? They can't trace it all to the Siberian route and to, some of it is Southeast Asian. Some of it they can see, you know, people had to come by boat over
there.
I mean, it's no longer a legend or, you know, make-believe.
Well, the Maori say that they came from what's now Syria. And the Maori, the Mauritania in northern Africa, which used to be that's part of the Roman Empire, but that is the homeland of the Phoenicians, which are also known as the Maru or the Mauru people, and they were basically chased out of the Mediterranean a couple thousand years ago. But they They pretty much stayed in their ships, and they were all over the place.
Yeah, they took coastal routes. They didn't like to go inland that much.
Right.
They also didn't go that much out to sea. They kind of hugged the coast and had their port cities that they'd go and they'd do some trading with, right?
That's right, but they had plank ships that required pitch. And there was Phoenician ships that were found in Catalina Island off the coast of California because they were there when the sea levels were different. They were going into the La Brea tar pits for pitch.
Well, the other civilization in Mexico, actually the sea, you know, the mother civilization, the Olmecs. That's fascinating artifacts in that culture.
Uh-huh.
I was really blown away when I was down there to run into that, because it was unexpected to me. I knew about the, you know, the Negroid-looking heads, those big basalt heads. That was one thing, and helmeted heads, but when you really look at the full range of artifacts down there, it's all races.
Well, yeah. The...
I mean, it's, you know, Orientals, I mean, beautiful jade carvings of, you know, Oriental men. You've got... You've got
jade carvings of turban-wearing, non-Mayan-looking people
right.
With this, I call it a ski-jump nose, but that it kind of inverted nose, which was common to the two traits of the Wahpetitas clan, which is really the Catua clan, the people of the original towns, is the inverted nose, not the aquiline nose, and webbed fingers. And those things have been found... showing that we were living down among the Mayans or near them, alongside them, or whatever.
Well, the Olmecs preceded the Maya, right?
Yeah,
the Olmecs preceded the Maya. That looks to have been a mixed race civilization.
Right.
With the Maya, were not. But they were a mixed race civilization, and you find people with Semitic features, Caucasian. Everything within that civilization, and yet it's the earliest and most mysterious in Mexico, but most people just focus on those big heads and don't realize there's a lot more, there are a lot more anomalies to that.
A friend of mine in New York City, he's a school psychologist, and he's married to the state dancer of India, and he is half Indian, and the other half's pretty much woodland Indian, Nottoway in particular, Nottowiga. And he was talking with some Chickasaw elders, and he asked them what clan they belonged. Well, first of all, he asked them, where did you come from? And Chickasaws told him that they came from across the Eastern Ocean to Mexico, and then follow the coast up to where they are now, which is, you know, the Mississippi area. And he was querying them about the ancient name of their clan, and he was absolutely astounded when they told him the name of the clan that his father had told him when he had married him in India. His father was a high caste East Indian. When you get married over there, you're not told the name of your clan until you get married. And it was the same clan. he pointed out all the similarities between that culture in India and in the Cherokee language also. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, all of these, you know, we haven't gotten into Atlantis. I've written a book about Atlantis, just the best evidence that I've come across over the years, and, you know, both sides of the Atlantic, and we're kind of touching on some of it, but yeah, you find, you know, in Hindu texts, they talk about Atala, which was Atlantis, which was a land east of North Africa.
Right.
They talk about it being an island. It conforms to, you know, what Plato was saying, what Herodotus, this other historical writers were saying about Atlantis. And then you have Aztlan. I mean, you have, you know, the Aztecs and the people over here saying, you know, we came from a different land, and it must have been an island because that's what Tenochtitlan, you know, was built in the form of an island with causeways leading in and out, with a central pyramid precinct. But that's, you find that in the Olmec region too, at La Venta. Same kind of thing. They built on a swamp, and they could have picked, you could pick dry land. I mean, Valley of Mexico was huge. You could have picked dry land, but they picked a swampy, you know, shallow lake instead. So all of the, you know, these ancient histories that have been passed down and then dismissed by modern scholars for a few hundred years now are proving to be true. And
well, the key I understand from reading Lucille Taylor Hansen in her book Ancient Atlantic, which you may have read, she was the lady that wrote He Walked the Americas, and about the white-bearded god that visited us about 2,500 years ago. But she pointed out, you know, a lot of these traditions about the old red land, which was the origin place of a lot of the tribes that are in North America, and the connection between the trident, which is an Atlantean symbol, and you know, it's not the realm of New Age woo-ism, where we're talking about facts that are not scientific facts yet, but you know, the continental drift theory was originated by L. Taylor Hansen's father and another man, and she followed up. You know, she wrote a lot. She was a lawyer, and she wrote in pulp fiction, but she wrote some good solid works. But the point that she made in Ancient Atlantic was that the real work needs to be done in linguistics.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osmond.
Put
it under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you
no,
tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
And what do we see in science fiction today? When you watch Stargate, the most important thing there is linguistics.
Well, partly, you know, what I'm using a lot now is the latest genetic research, which anthropologists have a lot of trouble with.
Yeah, that doesn't lie.
Because, like, when you come up with the haplogroup X, you know, and it's on both sides of the Atlantic, then you have to wonder, well, what's the origin then? Because these people weren't supposed to have contact. Where was there a common ancestral point where they were all in the same area? Because you don't find X in sub-Saharan Africa. You don't find it in Asia.
What are you talking? Maybe Basques and Kurds?
Yes.
Okay,
Basques,
those are the ancient.
Basques, Berbers, the Canary Islanders.
Yeah.
They've got it, and then
Maoris, no doubt.
Pardon?
The Maori, no doubt.
I don't know if they have that or not. That it spread out. It went north from Europe, but it went from that area of North Africa and the Iberian Peninsula. But then it's among northeastern tribes. I think. I'm trying to remember the tribes now.
Because the connection between the Tuareg, you know, North Africa and
the Berber tribe, right.
Yeah, and these cultures over here in North America is amazing. So yeah, that North American area, and the North African area, you got the Phoenician Phoenix, the Phoenician Venice, Venetian, the Maori connection all over the place.
Herodotus just called the people there, but the ancients called them all Libyans, right? They, which confuses us because we think of modern day Libya. They actually called North Africa Libya.
Morocco.
He called those people Atlantoi. The Atlantoi. And you know, we have the Atlantis Mountains. We have just a group of people that have been in North Africa for 50,000 years. They were once thought to have, migrated from the east, west, but that hasn't been proven out.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, they could have come, there have been Egyptian panels found in Australia. There was a vast repository of Egyptian artifacts that was found in caves in the Colorado River that was collected. The caves exploded and everything was taken out to sea out of San Diego and destroyed. But you know, you wonder, well, where did Egypt come from? Did Egypt come migrate?
Well, the Berber language, right, is an ancient. It's a dead tongue. Well, it's not a dead tongue among the Berbers, but the early Egyptian, the ancient Egyptian, was the same language.
And the connection between the North Africa and the Gaels and people in Ireland is established.
And they have the same rare genetics.
Uh-huh.
It's linked to Ireland, the people of Ireland, Scotland.
And the symbol of the harp.
Not the rest of the Brits. The Brits, they're different groups. And they all share the same legends, the same accounts,
yep,
that they came from another land. Now, they call the land differently on an island out there, whether it's Avalon or Atala or whatever. There's strong agreement. There's something else, though, about those people, right? The Berbers and the Basques, and we know the Basques are, their language is not related to any European languages.
Right.
They're very ancient. They preceded other Europeans, the Aryan groups that came up. They've maintained their way of life. They've maintained their independence. The Berbers have been you talk about the Phoenicians. They were overrun by the Phoenicians, then the Romans, and then the Arabs. That's their history for the last, 3,000 years. And still, they've maintained their autonomous identity. They're actually reasserting it now that they want to maintain their independence. They don't want to be totally absorbed into the Arab and Muslim cultures. And they have very ancient traditions. Well, the Basques have done the same thing. I mean, it didn't matter whether the Romans, the modern Europeans, the French, the Spanish. These are people with some kind of very strong root identity. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And they don't feel close, even though, they're Caucasian. They don't feel that close to modern people considered Caucasians there in Europe.
No, their cultures are too old.
Right, exactly.
Look at the struggle the Kurds have gone through. And, of course, the Basques have had their nationalistic movement But now these people, Native Americans, all these people, they're all oppressed by one, for one reason or another. And I have my theories about why that is. And I feel that, for whatever reason, the way cycles move, I believe all of these people are going to be coming out of that oppression because their oppressors are so dependent on technology. When they lose that technology,
exactly,
the people that know how to survive are going to survive.
That's right.
And those will be your low-tech, older cultures that understand.
They already know it because they've already seen it so many times.
Right.
Look, the Berbers are still there with their language. The Phoenicians, the civilization came and went. What language? The Romans, too. Latin is dead. The Berbers are still alive. They're still practicing their culture that's gone on who knows how long, continuously. The Hopi too, right?
Yep.
Other,
The Cherokee are a little weird. They you know, the ethnologists believe we're Iroquoian, but our traditional society, the Katua society, says that after we fought the war with the mound builders and intermarried with them, as we moved into the Ohio River Valley, we encountered the Iroquois, fought a vicious war with them, and Cherokees have always, we'll fight if we're pressed to the wall, but we'd rather make peace. So we're taught that we stopped the war with the Iroquois by intermarrying. By stopping to speaking our language and speaking their language. So that explains, you know, that's, but when you look at like the Monataka stone, which was a calendar stone that was kept in a cave complex down around Little Rock, Arkansas, and one of those keepers will be on our show here in a few weeks. But that had very obvious Mayan connection, and a book has been written by Raven Hill recently concerning the Cherokee calendar and its connection to the Venus cycle. So, yeah, we seem to have a strong connection to, not that we were Mayan, but that we lived alongside them and migrated up here and have a couple of times.
Well, that's pretty much what I have in the Atlantis book that I'll be publishing hopefully later this summer, that the migration pattern went from the Mayan region up to the mouth of the Mississippi.
Right.
The Mississippi.
Well, they had that terrible drought in Yucatan, you know, about 1600 years ago. And that was the time that we came up here was about 1500 years ago. And there's a lot of interesting things about what happened 1500 years ago. Our next Dick Greenstone is going to be talking about that. Some of the things that happened here in North America, and actual written records that were found here that talk about what happened 1500 years ago. That'll be interesting. So you got a new book coming out. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll get released at the end of summer. So.
Well, I hope I haven't bounced you all over the map tonight.
we've covered a lot of territory.
It's fun to kind of pick your brain, and but the first time I heard you was on Art Bell. I understand you were recently on a Whitney Strieber show, and we're very well received there. And
it's been nice. That's gone nice, and it's fine, you know, with me to go all over the map, or if sometime we want to talk later down the road.
Oh yeah.
On something or whatever seems appropriate, you know.
Yeah, I think what I'd like to do is every month or 6 weeks maybe have you back on for at least an hour to give us an update on what's going on. I think that's what we'll end up doing, is having a regular guest, you know, for an hour and a half each week, and every other week or so we'll have somebody come on for half hour, an hour, and just giving us an update on what's going on, and that way maybe we can have a couple of guests on each week.
Sounds good. Sounds like a plan.
That sounds real good.
I'd be happy to. Just let me know, and now we'll get together again.
Well, absolutely. You feel like you're talked out for tonight?
I have pretty well talked out.
Okay. Well, you were concerned about your voice earlier. I know what it's like to get...
Yeah, I was having, you know, it's kind of allergy season out here right now.
Yeah.
And I was getting that little tickle that tells you, you know, watch out. So, but it's holding up okay. And
well, we sure appreciate you being on Prophecy Keepers Radio. And so you're at... give folks your internet address again.
www.genesisrace.com, and my email is on there. You can ask me any questions. Like I said, I answer all letters, and be happy to.
Yeah, well, I know you do that because you wrote me.
Right.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you for providing the forum.
Hey, absolutely, absolutely, and bless you in your ways and in your travels.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you then. Bye-bye, Will. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing, and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files, and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
There is a growing movement of people who are deciding to make their lives better. At LifeVantage, we're in the business of change, of improving quality of life globally and restoring the ability to make dreams a reality. Your quest for personal fulfillment begins here. Our flagship product, Protandem, the Nrf2 Synergizer, is the key to fighting oxidative stress. This daily supplement, comprised of natural ingredients, activates the body's antioxidant enzymes to eliminate free radicals, which cause oxidative stress. Protandem has been tested in the laboratories of renowned universities such as The Ohio State University, LSU, and the University of Colorado, Denver. These studies found on PubMed.gov, the U.S. government's online scientific library, clinically show that Protandem reduces oxidative stress.
When I saw that Protandem reduces oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days, I was all in for the rest of my life.
Everyone begs us for science as an industry. Where's your proof? Well, we have that also.
LifeVantage is devoted to advancing Nrf2 science and leading the fight against oxidative stress.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Everybody, Marie's going to stay. You keep it here because up next, she's going to set the record straight about a long-standing rumor. Don't miss
Uh-oh.
It. We're back with the very blonde Marie Osmond.
Hello.
And during the commercial, we were talking, and Marie was letting me know. I did not realize that she is one of the co-founders of the Children's Miracle Network, which... It's been about 30 years since it's been in existence and raised billions of dollars for all the proceeds.
Well, this year we'll reach $5 billion for children. And the best part, it's really fun, is that 100% of it has gone to the children.
Good
so,
for you.
Yeah, it's really cool, very unique, nothing like it. It's the number one charity out there for kids of its kind.
And she was saying that she doesn't name her, lend her name to a lot of things, but tell us about your project with the Wise Food Company.
I'm so excited, you guys. You know, I get asked to endorse a lot of things, and my dad always said two things you protect, your beliefs, your values, and your good name.
Mm-hmm.
So don't lend it out to everything. You know, make sure that you're doing things that you really, really believe in. That is a crazy ring. Shut up.
Thank you.
Okay,
thanks,
anyway,
Marie.
Sorry, I'm blonde. No. So anyway, I come from this family where we used food storage. I know that sounds crazy, but with everything that's been going on, look at Sandy, just here alone.
Yes.
What was it, like $78 billion of damage?
Mm-hmm.
Look at the fires that are going on and the tornadoes and all of that. To not be prepared, we have car insurance, we have health insurance. Why do we not have food? I have done this my whole life. This company has only been in existence now for 4 years, but of all the companies, this is the best.
What
the
is
meals,
it? What do they do?
It's called Wise. Mm-hmm. The meals are about $1 a serving. It's the best food you've ever tasted. It's not your grandma's food. It's not beans and rice and gross stuff.
How do you make it?
Literally, it stores for 25 years. Put it under your bed, and you open up a package, put water, and you eat it. Put it in your car, you know, if you get on a tornado or whatever.
Yeah, when you're hard-pressed and you want something to eat.
I put two meals in the bottom of my children's backpacks that they take to school in case something happens, so I know they always have something to eat. I'm a mother. I'm a child advocate. And I could, seriously, guys, I could lend my name to a bazillion things. But I believe in this, and I know that this company is the best. I swear to you.
Well, so are you.
No, I did.
Yes, I've enjoyed our conversation.
You're the best.
I've really enjoyed meeting you, Marie.
Well, you're so darling.
Osmond.
Yeah.
Marie Osmond, everybody.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods,
visit wisefoods.org.
Let the truth